Welcome to Unforbidden Truth. I'm Andrew. On this week's episode, I'll be speaking with convicted murderer Keene Crawford. On December 6, 2008, Keene was at the residence of Anthony Brown, his sister's boyfriend. The two men had been drinking when a fistfight broke out after Keene punched Anthony's wife in the eye. Anthony stepped in between the two of them, and Keene then shot Anthony several times with a pistol. That was the prosecution's account of how the shooting occurred. According to eyewitnesses, there was no fistfight that took place between Anthony and Keene, nor was Keene seen punching Anthony's wife, but that an altercation between Keene, Anthony, and another man ensued as Keene and his family were leaving the house. Anthony was shot shortly after he came out of his apartment. Keene was arrested for the shooting death of Anthony Brown. He was charged and ultimately convicted of second-degree murder and assault, receiving a 104-year prison sentence, 30 years suspended. Here is my interview with Keene Crawford.
Collect call from an incarcerated individual at Spring Creek Correctional Center.
Where were you born?
Fairbanks. It's like the middle of Alaska.
What was your first positive memory as a child?
Oh, I think Christmas time. I'm not 100% sure, but I think my dad was still around.
Were your parents together throughout your childhood?
No. No, they broke up when I was about a year and a half, two, something like that.
Was both your mother and your father in your life?
Not really. I mean, my dad hung out for a while. He was from California, and he came up for a pipeline job, like, in the 70s. And then I was born in 80, and they split up, and he ended up... jobs in Alaska are weird. You're always off somewhere. Like, he worked on cleaning up the oil on the slope a lot, the union job, and then eventually he went back to California.
Did he leave your life completely? Like, did he just leave the picture, or were you still in touch with him? Did you still go and visit him and whatnot?
Still, like, lots of phone calls, like more phone calls than is pleasant. Like, it was a very unpleasant experience being a little kid and having your dad call on the phone. What I never wanted to do to my kids. It's kind of the idea, and I ended up doing it anyway.
Did you suffer any childhood abuse or trauma?
Yeah, I'm not sure. We spent a lot of time in daycares and babysitters. Mom was a single mom working all the time, so I mean, I have like, I don't know. I didn't like being at those places. Nothing specific.
Were you ever, you know, like physically, sexually, emotionally, you know, mentally abused?
No, I think I was probably more just left alone.
More neglect than anything?
Yeah. So, you know, when I hear other people's stories, being left alone ain't that bad.
Were you left alone in the sense of there was no parent at home?
Yeah, I had a little brother.
Would you and him be left alone?
We'd bounce around. Like, a sister would babysit us sometimes, which she hated. That wasn't really fair to her. Quick rundown, I had an older sister who's kind of at the center of this case with me. She was born in 74. I was born in 80. By the time I was born, her dad had already died. My mom had remarried and divorced once and then remarried my dad. So... my dad was like her third dad, and then after they broke up, my mom remarried my younger brother's dad, whose name is Martin. Martin Nichols is my stepdad, I call him that, and then Carrie Nichols is my sister. And so she got stuck, looking back on it now, I used to think she was just meanish, you know, meaner than shit, but really she was way older than me and the younger brother, so she got stuck with us all the time. She had to babysit us, she got put with a lot of responsibilities.
What was your behavior like growing up, starting as early as you can remember?
I used to get in a lot of fights with my, not fights, but disagreements, you say, with my family about, it sounds weird, but like little things like killing bugs or something. Like that was my thing. I used to get in fights at school over that too. I remember the elementary school I went to was Nordale Elementary, and we lived like two blocks up the road from it, so I could walk there. And then we had, like, this is the 80s, so the slides were metal still, like the old school metal slides. And I remember, like, these kids would catch ants in a plastic baggie and then magnifying glass them under the thing. And we had tons of daddy long legs, so there's always kids pulling legs off the daddy long legs. And I'm not saying my family tortured animals, but I never really felt like I fit in with them. I had a counselor one time, and he said the reason I became a vegetarian was to be contrarian or obstinate somehow. But I don't know if that's it. But I was a kid. I was like 4 years old, and my younger brother's dad, Martin, was, and my mom, they were chopping up a caribou in the backyard. And my mom said I'd always ask her, like, she said I was just a curious kid. Like, when the food came on the table, I'd ask what it was, where it came from or whatever. So she never gave me the meat talk. So my meat talk was a caribou hanging on my swing set. And I didn't freak out. Everybody thinks I freaked out. I didn't cry. I was just curious what they were doing because I didn't know. And they explained that it was food. And I guess that was, she said I ate a little bit of meat for like a couple weeks after that. And then I completely quit. And she let me, which is nice. She didn't have to. She could have forced it, but. But I just never, you know, you never really feel like you fit in. Everybody else is going hunting and fishing and whatever.
What was your behavior like in school, primarily in your middle school and high school years?
I mean, I never really felt like I fit in at all. But I was smart. I mean, I was intelligent enough. I got decent reports. And then junior high, I just quit going. Drinking, smoking weed all the time. Just anything but being, I couldn't deal with, there's too many people. I don't know if that makes sense, but like I would skip school. We had a library across the street, so I'd skip school and go with, we'd either go and smoke a little weed or something, or I'd go to the library by myself. They passed me 7th and 8th, even though I think I quit going around 7th, but they didn't, attendance wasn't really required until 9th, so 9th I totally quit.
What did you do after you quit school? What did you do with your free time?
Hang out and smoke a lot of weed. Didn't have a lot of hobbies. I'm sure it's everywhere, but there was a culture in Fairbanks of like real easy access to alcohol, and like that's what I would do if I wasn't at home, and just hang out with friends, I guess. Sure. I mean, I'd hang out at the library, read books. No family around to really make me do anything, so. I mean, I don't know. I was kind of a boring kid, I guess. I didn't do any sports, didn't do the normal things kids do, I guess.
So besides smoking weed and drinking alcohol, did you engage in any criminal activity prior to turning 18?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, tons, I'm sure. Just running around. Like, I guess I went along with it, but a little bit of joyriding. Lots of shoplifting.
Do you mean like stealing cars and taking them for rides?
Yeah. Just ditch them nearby. I mean, usually when you pick it up, it's within walking distance, so you have to drop it off within walking distance. I actually ended up working at a Chinese restaurant once, and I had, like, 5 years before, had, not even that long, probably 3 or 4 years before, had used to use their trucks every once in a while. So that was funny to tell that story to the guys that worked there, because they remembered the trucks, how they get dropped off at Alaska Land, they'd have to go get them. But nothing, I had some friends that got into, like, started doing cocaine was the thing then. There was no meth or heroin around. That got really weird because they were, like, go and do burglaries and things. They needed money all the time. And if all you got, like a bottle of alcohol costs $20, a bag of weed costs 20 or 40, there was no need for like actual criminal enterprise. So I would call it stupid kid shit, but I mean, technically, yeah, it's criminal.
Let's talk about the 2008 shooting of your sister's boyfriend, Anthony Brown. Can you walk me through everything that led up to the shooting and what followed the shooting that day?
Moved to Anchorage in 04, fall of 04, because of the different school programs. I had been going to UAF, but I wanted to switch to UAA. And it was kind of nice to go to a new town after living in Fairbanks my whole life. So we moved down. I had two babies at the time, because they were born in 03 and 04. And my wife, my ex now, and just went to school, worked, that kind of thing. And then November 08, my kids were telling me about some neighbors that had, and I decided, like, well, first I thought I would tell the cops, and then that didn't really get any response. So I said, well, we got to go. I'm not going to live here around these people. And it was getting late. It was December, so it gets dark early and snowing. And the road back to Fairbanks is not a good road. Like, there's lots of turns and bends. You got to drive through Denali Park. And in the winter, December 7th, I think, I've driven, we're from Fairbanks, so I would drive, like, every holiday. We drive up to Fairbanks a lot, like, to see the in-laws, mostly my wife's family, because I didn't see my family that much. But, so we drive the road a lot, the highway. But at night, on the highways, when all the big trucks drive, they don't drive during the day when there's just regular people, many cars on the road. So think of, like, I've done it a couple of times at night, and it's not fun, like big double trailers. It can go 70 even on the turns and stuff in the mountains because they're so heavy and they got chains and stuff. They're not going to fly off the road. So imagine getting past pitch black, getting passed by a big double trailer with snow blowing everywhere. And you can't see where the road is anymore, so you've got to slow down and feather it, hoping you don't get hit from behind while you're trying to see what's in front of you. And I didn't want to do it. I wasn't going to do it at night. And I should have went and got a hotel room. But my only family in Anchorage was my sister, my older sister. She had moved to Anchorage. And she had my nephew, who was 10 at the time. And then Martin, my former stepdad, back from we stayed in touch. We're still like family. So I called both of them. And they came over to my house in Anchorage. I lived in a trailer because I owned it, and so I only had to pay the $350 rent. So it was good for going to school, not having lots of bills and stuff. But they came over there, and I told them what my kids had said, and I told them, like, I've got to get out of here or whatever, and that the cops had kind of blew us off. Even a neighbor child had told his parents something, and so one of the other parents from the neighborhood went there with us to the police station, and they were like dismissive and hostile at the same time. So I asked my sister, I said, look, I'm the only one who's asked him any questions about what happened. Would you be willing to ask him some questions too and see what they tell you? Because it was some pretty heinous stuff, and it was very specific stuff, and she agreed. So we went to her house, but we stopped by Costco, and I, like, the Discovery pictures are funny because they're everywhere they look to take a picture of a bullet hole or whatever, there's pizza boxes or chips or, I thought we were going to have a picnic is what I thought. So we bought like 3 or 4 big pizzas, big bags of chips, big jugs of juice, and, knew her boyfriend a little bit, and so I asked her, hey, is it cool? I mean, can I smoke a little weed with him? Are you going to get upset? She's like, no, she didn't care. And I bought a case of beer because I thought that was the thing to do to be a nice guest or whatever. And we went to her house and had a picnic. That's like as far as everything was still kind of okay up to that point. We got there. I guess her boyfriend had been locked outside trying to get in. He didn't know where she was. They had an argument. I told her, like, look, just give me the pizzas. We'll leave. We'll split them up is what I said. We'll split them up so they could have half, we could have half. I told her I didn't want to bother her. And then her and her boyfriend were like, no, 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 it's no big deal. You guys should stay. Come in, whatever. So we, the kids, we come inside, or we're on our way inside. And this third guy shows up, Daryl Nicholson, who I didn't know who I didn't know his name, nothing. My sister kind of bitched at him as he was pulling up, saying she didn't want the people he was with knowing where she lived. I was never going to introduce to him or nothing. So we all go inside. The kids are playing because my kids, who were 3, 4, and 5 at the time, hadn't seen my nephew, who was 10 at the time, in a while. So they were all playing, running around. Me and the boyfriend smoked the joint on the porch. We talked. We go inside, and when we go inside, he says, where's your sister? And I said, I have no idea where she is. Like, her bedroom, the bathroom, I don't know. He looked around the apartment, couldn't find her. He says, she must have left. I'm going to go try to find her. So he left. Find out later that she had left before we even went outside, and she had passed Daryl on her way out. He didn't say anything, though, to either of us, me or Tony. So this is what happens. He leaves to find her. They're gone for like 45 minutes. The whole time they're gone, this Daryl guy is like yelling at my kids, being, not threatening, but I would say like hostile. My wife said he tried to give her a hug one time while she was walking into the kitchen. Basically, he was acting like a weirdo. I felt like I was getting weirdo vibes off of him. And said it is leaving, and leaving my nephew there, because I didn't know who the guy was. I thought, well, my sister will be back any second. Like, she's only going to be gone 5 minutes, right? Okay, she's only going to be gone 10 minutes, maybe 5 minutes more or whatever. I should have just left. Somebody told me I should have just took my nephew with me and drove around until I found her, if I didn't trust the guy because I didn't know who he was. But I just sat there waiting for her to show back up. And when she showed back up, I was like, hey, look, I don't really feel comfortable with this guy. I don't know who he is. All he's been doing this whole 45 minutes is yelling at the kids. This isn't going the way I thought it was going to go. We're going to leave. And she's like, no, 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 no. You guys could stay. You guys go. You stay in Trayvon's room. He had bunk beds. And the kids had been in there mostly. Marie was in there. I was like, no, I don't really feel comfortable around this guy. Like, I don't know anything about him. So he's some homeless guy that was a friend of Tony's that was living there, I guess. What's fucked up is she's like on my side, or making me feel like she's on my side this whole time, saying, no, he can't do that, blah, blah, blah. So she tells him to leave. She tells Daryl to leave. She says, no, you can't be yelling at the kids and shit. You got to get the fuck out of here. He doesn't leave. He goes outside with Tony, and he'd been trying to get, like, he's been trying to pick a fight with me. Daryl had been trying to pick a fight with me. And I was like, no, so I agreed at first. I was like, sure, fuck you. Let's just fight then. I don't like you either. And he's like, no, you're going to fight. He tells Tony to fight me. I was like, I'm not fighting him. I don't have any problem with him. You're the one that wants to fight. And I realized, like, no, this is just getting weird as fuck. I'm just going to leave. So I'm standing there talking to Carrie. Tony and Daryl are outside. And I was like, Carrie, look, I don't know. I'm not staying here. And she's at this point still telling me, like, oh, it'll be fine. You guys just stay in Trayvon's room. At no point did she ask me to leave because I just left. I wouldn't have stayed that long if she hadn't been trying to convince me to stay. And I sympathized with her because it was a weird situation. And I'm not used to her being in those situations because she was pretty much like our mom growing up. Like, she's always in charge of everything. You know what I mean? So this was weird, and I was like, nah, we're going to leave. So when they come back inside, Tony and Daryl come back inside. Tony's all amped up, and he's coming at me like he wants to fight me. And I said, Kenny, Joey, Alex, get your coats, get your boots. We're out of here, was my exact words. I yelled them because they were in the back. Marie was like halfway in between, she said. So she said, like, she was coming back in the living room, but then when she heard me yell, she ran back out of the living room to go get the kids in the back. And I was just standing there next to Carrie by the couch thinking, like, okay, fucking, I hope this is over with soon. And he hit me from the side, Tony did, once or twice. I fell on top of Carrie. And as I fell on top of her, he came down on top of me and put his hands around my throat, and still not thinking of shooting anybody, anything like that. My response was just to try to lift him up off of me. So I grabbed his throat and tried to, like, pick him up off of me. Problem is, he's like 200 pounds, 6 feet something. I'm 5'8 and like 130 pounds. So I wasn't going to get him off of me. That's the last thing I remember. Carrie told the police that she tried to pull him off of me. I don't remember that. She told the police that he said he was going to kill me. I don't remember that. I don't remember any words being spoken or anything. Just thinking I was going to die as this guy's choking me out. And I'm not going to get my kids out of the house because that's what I was trying to do. When I come conscious again, it's when I see Marie and the kids all dressed. Like I said, Alaska, December, so they're coats, boots, hats, gloves. And it takes a while to get three toddlers, three, 4, and 5 years old, fully winter dressed, right? So I don't know how long it's been, but it's been a while. They go out. I thought I got up and walked out after them and then fell down. I didn't. Carrie said Tony picked me up and pushed me out after them. And I don't remember that at all. I fell down a few times. I was blacking out, like vision closing, like vision narrowing, reddish-brown color, like a full-on, like, ears. Not ringing like a loud, high-pitched whine, but more like a, like that. So, I fell down a couple times on the way out to find them, because they're out waiting by one of the vehicles at the end of the driveway. And she said she called to me a couple times because she didn't have the keys, and that I wasn't. That's my ex, Marie Eustace, and that she said I didn't sound fully conscious. She said I sounded like I was asleep. And then right then the door opens. Daryl says something else to the guy, and that's what I remember hearing, the door creaking, hearing Daryl's voice, like, telling him something, giving some kind of command. And then I turn around, Tony's walking out the door, and I shoot him. Door closed. I'm still shooting. I dropped a clip, put in another one. I started shooting at the ground because I don't want him to come outside. And that's it. But I was still fucked up. Like, when we got in the car, neighbor came out. Well, I guess he was already out there. I didn't know this. Neighbor came out. Was out on the porch and said something, and I seen them, and I said, call the cops. And then for the first minute or so on the road, like, I wasn't even able to hold the car straight on the road. And we got to the police station. There's like a little side road off of Tudor. And I got there, and I was like, you know what? I'm fucking not going to leave you guys here in Anchorage, because they would have went back right back to the trailer park, which is where they went. Right next to the neighbors whom my kids had said had done shit to them when I wasn't around. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to fucking drive them to Fairbanks and then go turn myself into the troopers. And in Eagle River, we got pulled over, so that didn't work.
Do you remember when letting off the couple clips, where were your children at the time? Were they in range of where you were shooting, or were they behind, or were they somewhere safe?
No, they were behind me, and I guess on the other side of the van. So the van, the truck we had was out on the street. The pickup truck was in the driveway. The van was towards the end of the driveway, so they were on the other side of the van behind me, and then I didn't know this at the time. I just knew that they weren't between me and him.
When you were in the process of shooting, or after the fact for that matter, were you having to, like, calm your children down, you know, at any point? Because I'm sure letting off two clips, I'm sure they would have been, you know, freaking out or a little, you know, worried.
Surprisingly, just didn't know what happened. They heard the gunshots, but gunshots don't scare them. And when she asked, like, did it, I mean, they weren't, I think they were more scared by the whole situation. My wife said, so in my kid's statement, Kenny, the oldest, said he thought I was dead already when he seen me on the couch because my eyes were rolled back in my head and I was just getting jerked around. Carrie said it too in her police statement. She said he was jerking me around in front of the kids and making like a show of it or whatever. So my kids, like, I grew up going shooting range and stuff, and they've gone a lot with me. So gunshots aren't that big of a deal. Marie was scared. She asked if I had hit him, and I said, I don't know. I just know the door closed.
After you're arrested and charged with the shooting of your sister's boyfriend, were you offered any type of plea deals before your sentencing came about?
No, not at all. It wouldn't have been, to me, it wouldn't have been a good one anyways. It would have been, so the normal way they do this is they give you the public defender. They come with a deal. They spend about 2 years trying to get you to take the deal. You don't go to trial before 2 years with the public defenders. That's like the average on a homicide case. And I wasn't willing to do that. I wasn't willing to spend 2 years waiting to go to trial. I had a 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old. I wasn't going to take any deal, even if it was 20 years, because I have a 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old. I didn't start the fight. I didn't want to fight. I was defending myself and my family from an aggressor. So here's what I would have had to do. I would have had to fight a lawyer for 2 years, tell him, no, we're going to trial. And then they would have been so upset at me for going to trial that they'd throw it, which doesn't sound right or good or maybe real to you, but they can do it. They're like, well, I told you to take the 20. Now you're going to get 99, and then you get 99. So it didn't really matter that they didn't offer a deal.
You're ultimately convicted of both assault and second-degree murder, receiving a 104-year prison sentence, 30 years of that being suspended. How did you feel when you were handing down your sentence?
Like it was a joke. I didn't even stay for the sentencing. I walked out. His story at the end, the judge's story at the end was, you were mad because they wanted you to leave and you didn't want to leave. And I said, like, well, then he should have let me leave. Like, if he wanted me to leave, then when I was trying to leave, he should have just let me. So clearly nothing you're saying has any relation to reality. Suck it, bitches. And I left without the suck it, bitches. But yeah, I mean, it was a joke at that point. After going through the trial, so I got denied a medical expert, which would never happen if I was the victim. Like, if the state had any case where their victim had been strangled and that had been shown through photographic or DNA evidence, which mine was, no way you're not getting a medical expert. The state's going to get one every time to talk about how it's a threat to your life, all that shit, right? But because I'm the defendant, I'm not getting a medical expert. My sister changed her police statement to say that I was the aggressor in the house, and then she flew my nephew out of state, so I couldn't call him as a witness. The judge let her do that. The judge wouldn't tell the jury that there's no duty to retreat when defending children, because I would have won, because the DA couldn't fight the fact that the other guy was the initial aggressor, so they convicted me under duty to retreat. The jury still acquitted me of intentional killing. I got a full not guilty on that. And then I got more time than most guys get for premeditated killings. So it's a joke. That's how I feel about it.
Since being incarcerated, going on 13 years now, what's your behavior record look like? Have you got into many, you know, like fights or participated in any riots or anything like that? Or have you been pretty squeaky clean in there?
I'll actually, I'm about to file a clemency application, and I'll send you a, I'm going to send you a copy of it just because I got to read the letter that you sent. And I ended up doing like a caretaker job for mental health guys. And it was kind of amazing. I did that for 2 years, 8 months. And they came up with a rule that if you're not on the mental health caseload, you can't live or work around them. There were some abuse problems that didn't involve me at all, but had happened. So they made a statewide policy that if you're GP, you can't work or live in around the mental health guys. So I lost my job, but it was pretty amazing to work around guys that are, and they still committed crimes, but when you've got full-blown schizophrenia and hallucinations, it's different. You know what I mean? And they didn't get help out there enough, but then even in here, they still need help. They need people just to be there for them, listen to them, help them manage their conflicts with others. That was probably the best time out of my whole time. I did at the beginning. I mean, you know the joke about what you got to do when you first get to prison, right? You got to go right, find the biggest guy and do whatever to him. It's kind of true. I would, if any of my kids ever had to go to prison, I would tell them the same thing. And you don't actually start a fight, but you can't let anybody disrespect you even verbally, because it's a real quick transition that they follow from first verbal, then it's, you know, they want to take some of your property, then it becomes physical. And then by then, it's worse even when you do fight, because you've already set yourself up as being a prey. And then your only option is protective custody, which isn't good either, because I'm looking right across from a protective predators over there, sexual and otherwise. So you're not even safer in the PC mod. And I'm lucky that I had a couple violent episodes that were visible to lots of people. Now I'm just left alone. So it's been a while, but yeah, I did have to get violent in the beginning. Got to survive somehow.
What do you do on a day-to-day basis to keep busy in there?
Since I don't have the mental health job, I moved to GED tutor, which is what I was doing before that. And now with COVID, that's all shut down. There's nothing to do. Locked in the unit all day. We get 1 hour outside rec. I go jog for an hour, and then I come back in, and I read books. Books is that's my escape.
Before we conclude this interview, is there anything you'd like to talk about that we haven't covered yet?
I mean, I didn't want to talk about it at the beginning. I don't like dwelling on my childhood or whatever, right? Like, I love my mom and dad. They're both gone. Sure, they could have done things way better, but you know what I mean? It's not so sure. My childhood was shitty. My dad wasn't there for me. Nothing felt good since then. But that's just life. I mean, who the hell has there's people who have their mom and dad and they treat them horribly and religiously and emotionally abuse them, you know what I mean? So in a lot of ways, just being left alone really wasn't that bad. I wasn't tortured. I wasn't psychologically abused. I just got to do whatever I wanted, which I wish they hadn't done that. Like, I wish I had the parents who were there and helped lead you on the way and all that other shit, but it's not that big of a deal. but it's what you make out of it. I thought I was making something pretty good out of it with my kids. And then even when you want to be there for them, and even when you want to do everything right that wasn't done right with you, it doesn't matter, because the chaos of the universe can just come and tear shit to pieces anyway. So I just don't dwell too much on the childhood stuff. So
that was my interview with Keen Crawford. Thank you for listening.